Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very happy to be back here again in Auckland. And I, after a very interesting tour all around the two main islands of this country. I'm very glad that the chairman has given me a way out this evening, because he introduced me as the chief executive officer of the society, which is of course true, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to be wise. I have to deal with all kinds of affairs of a business-like nature, and I'm not necessarily, therefore, the soul of wisdom. So please don't expect me to be. Now, the search for happiness is obviously something which all men have been looking at from the beginning of time. Whatever we may call it, by whatever word, however we would describe it, if asked to describe what we were looking for, what made us happy, we would all be, I think, ready to admit that something in the nature of happiness was what we were seeking. We may call it, as I say, by many names. Some will call it security, for instance, and feel that some sense of security would make them happy. All religions during the past ages of civilizations and so on have provided that security. And whether we were thinking in terms of moksha or salvation or liberation, each in its own place in one or other of the great religions of the world, men have had a certain security in that, and have found a certain happiness, at least, in that security for some vague future about which they didn't know very much. On the other hand, we have seen the search for happiness in all sorts of places where one is unlikely to find it. As in the past, so today, I think the same thing applies. There are people who seek happiness in amusement. They feel somehow or other that if they go to the cinema six times a week, they're going to be happy. There are others who are obviously very interested in food. Certain countries of the world more than others, perhaps, where people are tremendously concerned with the cooking, with the cuisine. And so there are those who are looking for happiness at a rather gluttonish sort of level, so I call it. There are those who seek happiness in their love life, in their sex life, and who feel that by continually making love, that they are going to achieve the happiness that they want. Other people feel that possessions are going to give them happiness. And so they amass all sorts of things, they collect all sorts of things, and they think that that is going to make them happy. Some people are concerned with money and power and status. And these, throughout the ages, have been a cause rather of misery to others particularly than they have been of happiness to anyone. And I think the answer which might be suggested here, in the Theosophical Society at least, is that man is basically a spirit, and he has his roots in something very, very much deeper than just the physical material world in which we know him most easily as active. And if that be true, then it is unlikely that he is going to find the kind of happiness he seeks in the places where he is seeking it, and that really he will have to dive more deeply within himself, achieve a far deeper understanding of himself, if he is going to find the happiness that he's looking for. And so we see in history a very, very gradual process going on. Amongst those who were seeking for pleasures, there were always a few who realized that that was not the way. And they struggled on, often against enormous odds, trying to point out that there were other values which were more important. Vastly outnumbered, as they practically always were, by the more conservative, by the self-righteous, by the rigid people, by the dogmatically religious people, by the foolishly moralistic people, and so on, who were always unready to receive any new ideas about anything, they had a very difficult time. Social strata have been very carefully guarded. People who had privileges, people who had vested interests in one situation or another, one condition or another, one field or another, were very keen on protecting them. But people needed hope. And so they tended to turn largely to the scriptures and to interpret and accept the scriptures in an absolutist sort of way. We still find that in some people in different religious groups. Even in Christianity, we still find people who accept religion in an absolutist sort of way. Their interpretation of the Bible is the right one, quite irrespective of the fact that they have never studied the Bible. I don't mean studying the Bible in the fact that you read it and try to think about what it means, but I mean study the history of the Bible, which is perhaps one of the most interesting things that a Christian can do. And provided he's open-minded and fairly free, he will discover very many things from the very first verse of Genesis onwards. In the very first verse of Genesis, the translation is probably incorrect, for the word used or translated as God is in the Hebrew a plural word, Elohim, which may perhaps represent God in his many facets. Perhaps it represents many facets of the one God, but it does not mean the one God, the one and only God, in the sense that most people accept that word God. Elohim is quite definitely a plural word. And so on to the mistranslations, the alterations in perhaps the 4th or 5th century, all sorts of things you can find have happened to this Bible. And it is rather interesting for people who study it to find out what is and what is not the facts with regard to it. There was a great fear because of the Christian idea of one life only, which doesn't exist in the other great religions of the world. Where there is a belief in reincarnation, that man has many lives and not only one, then there is a very definite diminution of fear on behalf of the people in that particular faith. Just after the war, there was a very severe famine in Bengal, in India. One of my brothers was there at the time, associated with the governor, the viceroy's household, and they tried to send food to Bengal, but there wasn't any rice available, and Bengal is a rice-eating province. So they sent wheat from Punjab or somewhere like that, and although I'm not much of a cook, I understand it takes longer to cook wheat to make it soft and palatable than it does to cook rice. And it seemed practically impossible to get the people in Bengal to understand this. So they cooked the wheat, and it was still hard, and they didn't like it, so they threw it away. And this could be proved historically, I'm sure, and I don't remember the figures. But if I say that tens of thousands of people died, I don't think I'm exaggerating. Tens of thousands of people died who could have eaten wheat and didn't. And the fact is that they just don't mind dying in the same way as perhaps people brought up in the Christian faith would do. I think under such circumstances we should have fearful struggles trying to find something to keep us going. And you can see how that attitude colours many fields in our Western life. The attitude that you must get something done, or that you must keep life going as long as you possibly can, at any possible cost, and so on and so on. Whereas in the Eastern world, that attitude is more or less absent. So there was a clinging to life in the past. Death, so to speak, was something terrible, frightening. And although people claimed to believe in some sort of an afterlife, they didn't seem to believe in it very, very deeply. After all, many of us, I don't know exactly how it is today, perhaps when one attends cremations rather than funerals, it may make a bit of a difference. But I do remember funerals earlier on in my life, which were certainly not characterized, as far as one could judge, by any feeling on the part of the mourners that the dear beloved was going on to anything better. They behaved in a miserable kind of way, all dressed in black, and all feeling terribly sorry for themselves, and none of them really thinking about the dear departed at all. Their attitude was entirely selfish, thinking they were going to miss somebody. And they weren't at all interested in what was going to happen to that person. If you really think that your aunt or your friend is going to heaven, then you should be a little bit happier about it, and not merely be sorry for yourself. But that attitude perhaps is changing. But even so, we still have it with us. And we don't have, yet, in most places, a philosophical view of how something useful can come out of something which seems sad. And I would like to read to you some words of Emerson, which I think illustrate the kind of attitude that we might incorporate in ourselves gradually. It's called compensation. And yet the compensations of calamity are made apparent to the understanding after long intervals of time. A fever, a mutilation, a cruel disappointment, a loss of wealth, a loss of friends, seems at the moment unpaid loss and unpayable. But the sure years reveal the deep remedial force that underlies all facts. The death of a dear friend, a wife, a brother, a lover, which seemed nothing but privation, somewhat later assumes the aspect of a guide or genius. For it commonly operates revolutions in our way of life, terminates an epoch of infancy or of youth, which was waiting to be closed, breaks up a wanted occupation, or a household, or a style of living, and allows the formation of new ones more friendly to the growth of character. It permits or constrains the formation of new acquaintances and the reception of new influences that prove of the first importance to the following years. And the man or woman who might have remained a sunny garden flower with no room for its roots and too much sunshine for its head, through the falling of the walls and the neglect of the gardener, becomes the banyan of the forest, yielding shade and fruit to wide neighborhoods of men. A very beautiful statement. And it illustrates, I think, how the direction in which we can perhaps turn when we look at the things in life which are uncomfortable and realize that taking a longer view, something good will almost always come out of what seems unhappy when it happens to us. So for long years there has been basically little freedom for change, because those who, as it were, held the reins of power in most places of the world were very intent on maintaining it Yet it is only 200 years ago, I suppose, or nearly, when Voltaire found himself able to say, "I do not agree with anything you say, but I am ready to die for your right to say it." Here was really the beginnings of a change. The whole question of rights began to arise, and since then, of course, transition has come about slowly but with an increasing tempo. We have been through the Industrial Revolution, the tremendous growth and development of science and technology, the growth at the same time of the news media, the ability for people to travel far more easily and far further. Two great wars have taken place. And if I may not be accused of vaunting the Theosophical Society too highly, I believe that 100 years of theosophical thought has also brought about some changes from the very first moment that Manu Blavatsky set out to offer to the world once again the philosophy that we call theosophy. More recently, there's been the ecumenical movement in religion, and so on. And these things have, in fact, changed the world. The world is changed physically for the better in very many places. If you read biographies of people traveling in the last century, say over 100 years ago, you find that the scenes they describe in various countries are quite appalling. The poverty was too dreadful. The conditions in which people had to live were too miserable. The terribly unhappy condition of children, often employed when they were quite young, people who hardly saw the light of day. There was a sort of slavery, not only in the southern states of America, but a slavery of people in many of the developing countries as well. Today, all this is much better, really. Social services have been undertaken in a tremendous way in a great many countries all over the world. Too much social service perhaps results in problems because it looks as though man is expected to have to struggle in some way or other for certain things, and if there is no friction in his life, he often finds himself very unhappy. In some countries, as you know, and I live in India, so I know that land reasonably well, there is still desperate need. The people are appallingly poor. The population grows and grows incessantly. They suffer from the same sort of, illusion, perhaps, that many of us suffer in the West with regard to their food. When I first went to India in 1935, you got rice with the skin on it, so to speak, brown rice, which is supposed to be much more healthy, has vitamin content and so on. But now you find everybody eating polished rice, which is not really so good for them. But all through this, people in power have been afraid of transition, and they still are. They do not like to see their old order going. But it is being forced upon them by the advance that is going on around us. There's a change going on in the social strata in practically all countries, and in the old countries it's not so easy as it is in the new countries, perhaps. Stern measures have brought about enforced change in the totalitarian regimes. But we have to remember the danger here. In the words of the French philosopher Montesquieu, writing quite a long time ago, when he wrote this, "The inner corruption of liberty shows itself first in uniformity." And we have seen that sort of tradition in this century, especially in the totalitarian states. We have, I think, to be very well aware of the dangers of uniformity, because it happens sometimes before one realizes it. And it appears in many places. The world of fashion, for instance, to which so many people subscribe is a form of uniformity. The craze, if it is a craze, for blue jeans, which has affected the youth of the world, everywhere, practically speaking, in every country, is a form of uniformity. They may be comfortable, they may be practical, but it's a form of uniformity, and we should be a little careful of it, because we don't want an anthill civilization in the future. So these changes are going on, politically and in many other fields. The transition from old to new is easier in the newer countries, and we are seeing a leveling out. The development of brotherhood, whether you call it by that name or not, taking place in many parts of the world. The trouble about uniformity is that if you have a standard to which everybody is not willing to conform, you start to bully anyone who is different from yourself. And that can take place anywhere in any field, and it could even, I say it regretfully, it could even take place within the Theosophical Society. And it is a great danger for a society of this sort that we should develop certain dogmas and then try to force them on anyone. So classes and castes are on the move everywhere. The United Nations has brought a great hope, I think, to many people, imperfect though it yet may be. It doesn't yet represent the world as a whole, it still represents the parts, which are the various countries. It does tackle, however, major problems of food and health, although I still think the majority of the people of the world are not particularly concerned to know what some of the agencies of the United Nations are actually doing. Publications from the Food and Agricultural Department, for instance, show great concern about the future feeding of the world. They show a concern as to what people are going to eat and what can be produced in a certain area which is perhaps more beneficial to human beings in terms of feeding them than the things that they are producing at present. There are large areas of the world where you can't use the land for much else but for raising of cattle or sheep, but there are very many parts of the world which are used for the production of meat which could be better employed for grains and fruits and things of that sort. You could get far greater calories per acre to help feed the undernourished populations of the world. And it almost comes to a point where people can say, and some people do say, that excessive meat eating becomes a form of selfishness because you are taking the food, speaking as the world as a whole, out of the mouths of those who have nothing. And at the Vegetarian Congress in India in November and December last year, we were seeking for slogans, and one of the slogans mentioned was based on "one man's meat is another man's poison," was one man's steak is another man's starvation. I don't know how that will take on. But anyway, it has a certain punch to it, I feel. Pollution is still a major problem of the world. But it arises from selfishness, really, and the refusal to think. The possible solutions are there, they can be envisaged, but most people don't envisage them, so they don't do anything about it, and so the problem gets worse. So everyone needs to cooperate with these problems, and they normally don't do so. So we look at our world today, and we can see betterment coming about. Education is turning slowly, very slowly indeed perhaps, towards a deeper reassessment of itself. There are many people who begin to understand that exams don't really prove very much, that there are methods of teaching which are far better than others, and so on. The need for creativity in men is being recognized. the arts, beauty, philosophy, are being seen as necessary to the whole man. Education of the individual may be still far off, but people are already thinking about the whole man and the need to elicit from each child that which it has within it. If I may explain what I mean by this. In my garden, when I had a garden in England, I had a herbaceous border. And in winter time, there was nothing to be seen but the earth. Underneath the earth, there were many plants waiting to come up again in the spring. There were delphiniums, probably, and lupins, and Michaelmas daisies, and goldenrod, and I don't know how many other things. They were all waiting there under the earth to come up in the spring. And a man might come along the basket of plants and say, oh, there's a nice empty space. Let's plant something. So he proceeds to dig into the ground all sorts of other things. And what happens in the spring and the summer? A mess happens. Because all the plants, all the new plants and so on, they're all growing up together in the wrong place. Everything's muddled up together. Many things don't have as much light as they need. The whole herbaceous border is ruined until next year. It's done with goodwill, with good intentions, but entirely spoils the garden. And I suggest that that is sometimes what we do to our children. They have within them all the plants waiting to grow when the time is ripe. And we come along with our so-called schooling and we shove into them all sorts of other things so that the plants that are within them can't really grow properly. However, this is beginning to be recognized, but slowly it is true, but it is being recognized. There is more realization, although people may put it in different ways, for what you might call a spiritual growth, for an education in terms of ethics and morals to balance the scientific and technological advance that we see around us. And what is going to happen then to us all? There emerges today a far greater possibility of satisfying man's material needs and therefore what he thinks is his material happiness. And so we come to the $64,000 question that in spite of all this advance in the world, which is by no means perfect, but which has gone on and is advancing continually, is man, individually, more happy or not? Are we coming to the point where we can see that in spite of all his advantages, materialistic advantages, he isn't really any happier than he was before? Can we really say that in his deepest nature, man is satisfied? You see, everybody, when you come to analyze it, wants happiness that will last. He doesn't want happiness which will be here today and gone tomorrow. And what happiness can you have which lasts? There is only one happiness you can have which lasts, and that is the happiness which you find in yourself. Because as long as the happiness you have depends upon anyone else, even if it depends on your wife or your husband, he or she can take it away from you. So basically, one is forced to understand eventually that the only real happiness, and that is the happiness I think that we all are seeking, comes from within ourselves. So it is this, the problem has then shifted now away from the idea that happiness is to be found by the improvement of our physical surroundings. I do think that perhaps the improvement of our physical surrounding helps us to have a certain stability, a certain leisure almost, in which you can probe more deeply. So it is not wasted. I certainly don't think all this has been a waste of time. I think man is learning. During the last war, President Roosevelt announced the four freedoms: freedom from fear, from want, freedom to speak as you want, and to worship as you want. And there is a feeling that just because he's a man, he has a right to shelter, to food, to clothes, to work, and so on. All this is growing up, and it is very, very worthwhile that all that has happened that I've been trying to talk about in the past has happened. But we still have not found the happiness we seek. And this is our great problem. We are looking in the wrong place and we have to change. There has to come gradually a reassessment of our own natures and therefore a search within rather than without. Reverend Peter Marshall, who was the chaplain of the United States Senate many years ago, offered this prayer on one occasion at the opening of the Senate, which I personally think has value to all of us if we are considering what we really are, which is where you have to begin if you want to find happiness. We pray that the people of America, who have such progress in material things, may now seek to grow in spiritual understanding. We have improved means, but we have not improved ends. We have better ways of getting there, but we have no better places to go. We can save more time and are not making any better use of the time we save. Advantages. But they're not really yet doing us good. He goes on to say, "We need thy help, O Lord, to do something about the world's problems. The problem of lying, which is called propaganda. The problem of selfishness, which is called self-interest. The problem of greed, which is called profits. The problem of license, disguising itself as liberty. The problem of lust, masquerading as love. The problem of materialism, the hook which is baited with security." Material security, of course. "Hear our prayers, O Lord, for the spiritual understanding which is better than political wisdom, that we may see our problems for what they are." Now what's he talking about? He's talking about lying, selfishness, greed, license, lust, materialism, all vices, so to speak, which we have been taught to think about down the ages. And there they all are, but with our tendency to euphemism, which we all have in these days, we call them by pretty, pretty names and fail, therefore, to understand what they in fact are. Now, I mention that because I think that it is extraordinarily necessary that if one is going to try to understand oneself, one has to be completely honest. It is no good not facing facts so far as we're able to face them. And we should seek around us for what such assistance as we can find, which will help us. I had been going to say something about many of the problems which we still have, but perhaps I don't need to talk about them, but rather simply enumerate them, because it would be a mistake to think that we have solved all our problems. There are still problems of race and brotherhood, because man has not yet learnt that brotherhood has to be his way of life. There are problems of food and fertility of the soil and the sea. We don't listen to the experts about that. There's a need for some kind of world government to take care of the distribution of food, which it seems to me can never happen under our present economic system unless there's a super power of some sort which can force the distribution from the people who have too much to those who have nothing. There is still a lot to be done with education. Relationships are still tangled. There's a blindness to a need for change, a conditioning of ugliness, escapism from life, drugs, both medical and others, biological warfare and the arms race, power politics for selfish gain, no sense of one world, religious intolerance and violence, refugees, who cares? Crime and delinquency on the increase, why? The economics of greed, which rule our days, the economics of waste, equally, hopeless sentimentality, a lack of willpower, when people say, after all, what can I do? Of course everyone can do something if they want to. Cruelty, cruelty to animals, cruelty to men, in all sorts of ways. And when we think of these cruelties, we have to ask ourselves, which side am I on? Am I on the side of love when there is cruelty? Or am I on the other side? You can't sit on the fence. Class and caste still causing great troubles. The mentally deficient also increasing. Why? The sheep mentality of so many people who rush around doing the same thing as everybody else. Radio, television, comics, the spread of violence in the world, superstition, the false gods of money, power, status, where are chivalry, honor, consideration, reverence, words you don't hear very much today. All the problems of marriage, love, divorce, sex in the permissive societies, advertising, starvation that's going on all around the world, population, all the people who, instead of behaving like men, behave like rabbits and continue to populate without any thought, any more than the rabbit has any thought. But people still do it in many countries. Responsibility, and so on and so on. There are so many problems with us, we can't pretend we've got past them all. And so we find ourselves in a position of transition, looking for happiness. And with the coming of plenty in the West, the needs are therefore for something different. People have realized, especially young people, that things don't make their parents happy, and they leave home in order to try to find something that has more meaning. So there is an interest in what is called freedom, although it is difficult to define that word, self-realization and peace and so on. Things don't satisfy, so we have to go somewhere else. I think younger people today are in a very difficult situation, largely due to the failure of ourselves, people like you and me in my age group, to really be frank and honest. This is a cutting which I took from a Canadian newspaper a little while back, and it deals, interestingly enough, with a Roman Catholic university in Canada. What do young people see in this world 2,500 years after Buddha, 2,000 years after Christ, 1,300 years after Muhammad? Asked Dr. Hugh Keenlyside, newly installed Chancellor of Notre Dame University. He said they see a world, quote, in which war is eloquently denounced but assiduously practiced, in which all the great powers are solemnly agreed to abandon war as an instrument of national policy, and all have broken their pledge. He said students live in a world where racial, national, religious, and other prejudices, though frequently denounced, remain everywhere in evidence, and where we devote $50 to research in the natural sciences for every single dollar we use to study human and social problems which afflict us with growing intensity. These are among the things to be remembered by a society which becomes shocked, disappointed, or angered by a student problem. It can be described most justly as a problem that we and earlier generations have created by permitting the development and continuance of the kind of society which so many of our young people find repellent. This former chairman of BC, British Columbia Hydro, said that the best thing his generation had done was to produce a new generation repelled by much of the world they have inherited and trying in ever-growing numbers to do something to change it. I find that a very interesting statement from a man of that type in that position, and I think perhaps it's a good idea. The best thing his generation had done was to produce a new generation, repelled by much of the world they have inherited and trying in ever-growing numbers to do something to change it. But the use of force and the search for truth are wholly incompatible. Students have the right to be heard, but they do not have the right to prevent others from being heard. Well, I think that's an interesting view of the situation as it was a few years ago. Perhaps it has changed slightly since then. But what are we now looking for? Our world is conditioned by speed. Everybody wants to move. Instant nirvana is the idea which is held out by certain groups. And I think we have to be extremely careful with the groups that we deal with. There is a cry for participation, for communication, a huge interest in occultism, mysticism, life after death. There are interesting books on all these subjects coming out in dozens and dozens. Some of you may have read a book on one of these contingent subjects, written by a certain Dr. Caligula in America, where she has been concerned with showing how a kind of clairvoyant faculty can work, so that the interest in that sort of subject is not confined to the fringe groups, as they might once have been called, but is now being looked at in a much more scientific manner. The book which you may have seen is, I think it's called Breakthrough to Creativity. It's probably in the library here or in the bookshop. And it really concerns the woman who is now the General Secretary, the National President of our Theosophical Work in the United States. And all her life she has been clairvoyant. And in this book it is described how she helped in this cancer ward, not by visiting the patients, because she never went into the ward at all. She just sat outside and made notes while the doctors visited all the different beds. And then she told the doctors afterwards all about each case and what she had seen and what she thought should be done. She had a very developed power of that kind. And so we are getting more books of this sort. More Lives Than One is an interesting book, which some of you may have read, and there are others. The interest in the fringe side of things, as it was called, is growing every day. So today there is a realization that there is something more to be known, both in the level of what we would call the third object of the society, the level of the unexplained laws of nature, and also in the level of the powers latent in man. But as one of our earlier theosophists wrote, unfortunately, as is always the case in an age which has lost touch with spirituality, people today yearn for powers and for the development of suspected but scarcely accepted higher faculties. And in their blindness, they search outside themselves. So they take what they can from self-advertised teachers about how to gain and use psychic powers. And such teachings are always baited with personal benefits of one kind or another. This accounts for the many so-called psychical, quasi-mystical movements presently existing, and which in many cases are leading people away instead of towards the light. The plain fact is that the West today is being misled by psychical teachings which in themselves have nothing permanent. So we have to be rather careful where we look for help. People today are not so interested in listening to talks as to communicating and participating. But there has to be some kind of study, I feel, and investigation by each person into himself. Now, this brings one really to the key to happiness, which is oneself. Nobody else can give you that happiness but yourself. And it can only arise from one's understanding of what one is. Now, man is not just a body of flesh and bones. Psychiatrists, psychologists are very concerned with his mind and his emotions. And occultism has always maintained that man is a spirit wearing, as it were, or using certain instruments whereby he can gain experience in this physical life on earth. They usually go on to say that inner self of man uses many such instruments and comes back to this world school many times. His instruments are briefly concerned to keeping him in contact with the different fields in which they operate. This physical instrument enables me to do things physically. An emotional instrument, so to speak, a body of desires, often a very tiresome body, an emotional body which is very difficult to control and so on, keeps me in contact with the whole field of emotion, and something similar for the field of the mind. And the teaching of occultism is that man is, as it were, a horseman who is supposed to be controlling these three steeds, but he is not any of them. So that efforts have to be made by whatever way you wish to disassociate yourself from what you are not. This is one of the purposes of meditation, and meditation can lead one, initially at least, to an understanding of what one is not. You are not the horse of your physical nature. You can prove it to yourself so very easily if you wish to. I've been talking about food earlier on. The horse, of course, likes food. And when he's had a nice piece of cream cake, which your hostess has provided for him, she comes along with a plate and says, "Have another piece of cream cake." And she's longing, of course, for you to take some more. You may know, "I'm getting fat," which is true, unfortunately, and I don't need any more cream cake. But the horse, with which one becomes so easily identified, is, so to speak, licking its lips, you see, saying, "Mama, I want some more cake." And who wins? Well, sometimes one is able to dominate the horse, but in the majority of people are not concerned with this sort of thing, the horse nearly always does win. Now, you'll know from that, it's so easy, that you're not that horse. You have to treat it as your horse. You have it under your control. You give it the right food. You give it the right exercise, the right amount of sleep, and that you should give it a piece of sugar occasionally is very, very reasonable. Why shouldn't it have a treat from time to time? But it does not dominate you. The horse is not asking you endlessly for another bale of hay and you always give it him. It isn't like that. You have to control your horse. And similarly with your horse, of your emotions, which gets carried away so easily in all sorts of uncontrolled directions. Think how we react so quickly to things that happen to us without any thought at all. We simply have an emotional reaction which can carry us, if we're not careful, into actions which are harmful to someone else and certainly foolish for ourselves. So we have to develop some kind of awareness of that emotional nature within us, and learn to be different from it and to control it. The horse of the mind is perhaps the most difficult of all to control. If you ever sit and think or try to think about something, you'll find your mind wanders. That horse, browsing as it were on the tippets of the mind, will run away. You have to fetch it back, it'll run away again, you fetch it back, run away again. It's not easy to learn to concentrate. A friend of mine who was a Buddhist monk in Burma, he told me that they knew fairly well that the young boys coming into the monastery couldn't possibly concentrate immediately on a particular thing. So that they led them along slowly. If you, for instance, suppose you want to learn to concentrate, you take an orange. Take it home with you tonight, an orange, and put it on the table, and sit there in front of it and say, "I'm going to think about that orange for 3 minutes." 1 minute. Say 1 minute. I doubt if you were able to do it, with all due respect, unless you've practiced this sort of thing. Because your mind will wander. Perhaps you have an orange dress, which has gone to the cleaners. And it reminds you suddenly, "Oh, I must go to the cleaners and fetch that dress." And you're no longer thinking about the orange. Or it may remind you of the fact that you haven't been to the market to buy the fruit for next weekend. And so you're no longer thinking about the orange. Your mind goes off so quickly. Well, they realized this in the monasteries, and so they gave a sort of ring pass knot within which the novice could and was allowed to think. But if it was an orange, he was allowed to think of anything to do with oranges. The orange tree, the smell of the blossom, the number of divisions in the orange, the pips, etc., etc., making an orange drink out of it, and so on. Anything to do with the orange was permitted. And that, the average person can do. And then gradually the field was narrowed down until the student was able to think of what one might call orangeness. What is that essential something which makes an orange and not a lemon? And in that way one can develop a certain kind of concentration. And if you can do that, then you are on the way to keeping your horses under control, so that you have the beginnings of a freedom to understand what you essentially are. And that, of course, is the whole crux of the matter. Because that you, that inner you, which you finally discover, is the, how shall I say, it is both the source and the contributor, as it were, and the goal of your happiness. It is that knows happiness. It is in realizing what you are and in living the kind of life which is in keeping with that, which brings you the happiness that can't be taken away from you by anyone else. Now that happiness is involved, of course, with the deeper, ever deepening realizations of what you are, because there is no end, in a sense, to the realization of what one is. But it is extremely difficult for anyone, obviously, to talk about anything deeper than skirting about the subject as we are doing. After all, the whole goal of this evolutionary process, from the occult point of view, is that deeper realization of what one is in relation to the totality of the universal life. It is the supreme yoga experience of becoming one with God, and nothing less than that. This is the goal, and it is that which is the ultimate happiness that everybody is seeking. But it means a tremendous change in one's life. It means that you have to face up to certain conditions. You can find them in any true course of yoga, like Patanjali's yoga. You can find the sort of conditions that you have to face up to. They are challenges to you, and you must look at them. I would like to say you have finally to accept them, but I perhaps shouldn't put it so dogmatically. One has to realize that one's whole life needs to be changed. Madame Blavatsky, one of the founders of our society, made a number of statements which are known to our members, but not necessarily to some of you perhaps coming here less regularly. Be what he may, once a student has abandoned the old and trodden highway of routine and entered upon the solitary path of independent thought, he is a theosophist. Well, have we done that? We who are members, others, have we in fact faced that need that in order to know, you have to stand alone? You have to be able to take that solitary path in which you are no longer concerned what people think about you. You're prepared to be the only person, as it were, that thinks your particular kind of thought in the midst of many who will scoff and laugh at you. And it needs some character to do that. It needs of us that we look at the kind of life we are leading and see whether it's useful in this search or not. And if it is not useful, to change it, irrespective of what anyone else is going to say. She puts it in this way: the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy admits no privileges or special gifts in man, save those won by his own ego, his own eternal self. Through personal effort and merit, throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnation. Not an invention, not a discovery, good or bad, has been achieved by prayer, by ritual, by reliance on miracles, or the offering up of sacrifices to some deity. All that has been gained by work, by study, by experiment, by observation, by comparison. And again, unless one is prepared to devote to occultism his whole life, the superficial knowledge of occult sciences will only lead him, surely, to become the target for millions of ignorant scoffers. And again, if a man would follow in the steps of the Hermetic philosophers, he must prepare himself beforehand for martyrdom. What do we think of that? Give up all personal pride, all selfish purpose, and be ready for everlasting encounters with friends and foes. He must part once and for all with every remembrance of his earliest ideas on all and on everything. How many of us have done that? But this is the challenge. All this means that if you really want to know yourself, you are inevitably, you must really change your way of life. It is as though, how shall I say? It is as though there was a rope or something, and it just won't stretch from where you want to go, you see. You've got to let go at one end in order to grasp the other. You can't hold on to both. You can't have the best of both worlds. You can't have your cake and eat it in occultism. You can't. You must be prepared to give up one end in order to gain more at that end. To give up all of the materialistic, self-indulgent, emotional satisfactions in life in order to gain the happiness that no one can take away from you. That, as far as I can see, is the law, and there isn't any way out of it. He that would lose his life will find it. If you want to find your life, which is the real, eternal life of true happiness, which no one can take from you, then you must be prepared to give up what you have felt up to now has been your life. No one can tell you much about that goal. We can talk around it. One can imagine, and there's no reason why one shouldn't, although one's imagination may not be very accurate, perhaps. One can imagine that, for instance, size, time, place, space, all is very different in that kind of consciousness. I think we can imagine that. Some of the questions that asked, I was mentioning this to some people just the other day, you might ask someone who had been through this supreme experience, do you love everybody? Well, the result of it might be, of course, on you later, that you do have love for everyone, that is true. But in the experience itself, it wouldn't be true. Because the experience, essentially, is an experience of oneness. And when you say, do you love someone, you mean you've got somebody and somebody you love. Well, there's a duality involved. In the consciousness of the experience, there is not that duality as far as I can see. Because you and anyone you love, as it were, have become the love. So you've experienced something in the nature of love, which can then flow through you when you return to your normal consciousness, so to speak. But in the experience, that you can't say you love everybody, because there isn't everybody, and there isn't you. There's only love, so to speak. We have to lift everything up from experience, which is what we know so well, into essence or being. For us, truth is eternal, and we can reckon with probably that's true. Truth is eternal. But in that experience, truth wouldn't be eternal or not eternal or anything else. Truth would only be if you could say anything, and you probably can't speak, you would say truth is. That's all there is to it. You can't have any adjective or any further qualification. It simply is and has no beginning and no end, no size, no space, no form, no position, nothing. It simply is from beginningless time to an endless time, as it were. So that the experience is something which obviously in its fullness can never be described in words, because all our words were only limited. And I used to use in lectures, and so I, with the permission of the members who've heard me say this before, I will bring out again the idea which has always seemed to me to help us to understand this. Supposing you have a chicken and an egg, and the chicken comes out of the egg. In the egg he's had a certain experience of light and shade, of heat and cold perhaps, not much. He comes out into this world. Utterly and completely unimaginable sort of world from the point of view of being inside the egg. There is sound, there is color, there is light, there are trees, there are flowers, there's everything. How could he communicate that to this chicken that is still inside the egg? He can't. He can say the sun is shining in a blue sky, provided a chicken can say anything. But what do the people in the egg say? We don't know what you're talking about. What is the sun? What is blue anyway? They have nothing to go by. There's no measure with which they can understand anything he's saying. And he tries and tries and tries to tell them about the trees and the flowers. And finally, there's nothing left for them to do except to say, poor old so-and-so, he's gone nuts. You see. And if they're in a position to, I'm mixing my metaphors horribly, but if they're in a position to make life difficult for him, they will. And all throughout the ages, men who have been way ahead of their times have frequently been killed by the crowd, who couldn't understand. And yet the little chicken was right. He had had this experience, but he was totally unable to convey it. So the great mystics, really spiritual geniuses of the world who have had such experiences of them, true self, as it were, and all the bliss, the ananda, as they call it in India, the ananda, the bliss of that experience, cannot tell you and me about it. But basically, what they must say to us is, you have got to get out of your own egg. And that, as I've said already before, means, as far as I can see, effort and an entirely change in our way of looking at things. Instead of being content, as it were, wrapped up inside to go on growing inside the shell, we've got to exert ourselves in the opposite direction and break out of all the conditioning of our past and change ourselves completely, which is not at all easy, but which has to be done. I don't think there's any escape from it if we really want the happiness which can't be taken away from us by anyone. Our late president, Brother Sri Ram, in a few words which came to me on a Christmas card, quoted by a friend in France, quotes him as saying, when unity, this is an experience of unity, of course, when unity is established within yourself, everything is related. The whole universe becomes one vast tree of life. And once we enter the life of that tree, we can proceed to any point on its branches. It's a very beautiful way of putting it. Once we have some contact with the totality of life to which we belong and which we in fact are, then there is no limit to the discoveries which we can continue to make, and no limit to the happiness which we can enjoy, and in knowing of it, perhaps share it by leading a totally different kind of life amongst our fellows. So the key to happiness is yourself, is myself. the happiness that no one can take from us, the eternal, undying, indescribable happiness that those have who follow the way that leads to this supreme union of the little self with the self of the universe. Thank you.